Welcome to Linux Matters, a podcast featuring three experienced open source professionals as we discuss the impact Linux has on our daily lives. This is episode 33 and I'm Martin. This week I've been creating my own homepage dashboard.
Hi, I'm Alan. This week I want to talk about Gorse.
Hello, I'm Mark and I've been writing songs with Tux Guitar.
So a couple of episodes ago, I talked about switching to Kagi search engine, and part of that transition, I wanted to create my own homepage in my browser as another little sidestepping a collection point that the browser vendors, you know, deposit into your browser experience. And I found a fantastic project called Homepage Dashboard, or just Homepage.
Good name.
Yeah, it is a good name. Apt, I think.
Do people have home pages? I have a blank page when I open a new tab.
Right. So I've been configuring things like that. I've used, I think for the Brave home page, I go in and I customize it and I basically turn off every single widget except for the one that gives me statistics and metrics about how many adverts have been blocked and the time. But it's something that I routinely see and I feel like it's something I could be making better use of. So I saw a friend of mine was using Homepage, which I think you can get from Get Homepage something. It'll be in the show notes anyway. Get Homepage.
Of course.
And so what I wanted to do was integrate Kagi directly into my open a new tab page in my browsers, which I've done. But in so doing, I have learned that Homepage does a whole load of other interesting stuff. And I've started to configure it for each of my workstations, but I think this will have greater application in the future on a home server.
Am I the odd one out here? Like, does everyone actually use the homepage that's provided by the web browser or a slightly customized version of it? Because I turn literally everything off, so I just have a black square when I open a new tab.
I think I turn off all the suggested things in Firefox, so I just have things I've recently visited. So sometimes I have a handy button to go back to something I was on recently, but I don't do searches in the search box that's there.
Indeed. I haven't used those homepage features of the browsers to their intended extent for some years. I have turned off all of the provided things because when you go grubbing around in the browser policies, they are a means of telemetry gathering and things like that. And whilst I'm not a massive privacy nerd, I like to do what's reasonable to just break up my online profile and fingerprint so that, you know, organizations can't build a holistic view of me and my online identities. But as I was saying, I see the new tab blank page hundreds of times a day, and I thought, let's make better use of that. So enter Homepage, and the first thing I did, so Homepage has a number of widgets and features that you can configure. So you can use Docker to get it to run it on your machine, or it runs as a node module, and it builds a static website that by default runs on port 8082. And then it uses a series of YAML files to configure different aspects of what's displayed on that homepage. And the first thing you get is sort of a top bar where you can configure what system health metrics you want to be displayed, what icon you want to be displayed, what search provider you want the search bar to connect with, and things like current weather widgets and things like this. So the very top is this bar. And I've integrated that with Kagi, so I can hit new tab. I have a browser extension that auto-focuses the homepage search box, and I can just start typing and off I jolly well go finding things. And I was very happy with this until I started to poke around with what else homepage can do.
What else can homepage do, Martin?
Well, it can integrate with hundreds of different services. And by services, I mostly mean sort of things that you might self-host.
Ah, I'm listening.
Yes. So one of the things I first did was you talked about, Mark, the recommended sites that you've recently visited that you sometimes click on, well, it has a bookmark section, and I've populated that with the 25 places I most frequently go. So this is things like I've got a category for development, I've got a category for NixOS sort of documentation and reference material, one for shopping, and so on. You get the idea. And they're very attractive little buttons with icons and logos and links, and I can just hover in there and click on the thing and it will take me to the place I want to visit. And these were basically the websites that I used to have in my browser, but pinned somewhere. So I no longer have those pinned tabs, because now I can just open a new tab and then immediately click the place I want to go. So I don't have additional browser tabs cluttering up the place as a result of that change.
You don't have additional browser tabs, like of stuff that is open that you care about.
Yeah, I would permanently pin like Gmail, GitHub, notifications, my calendar, a whole bunch of things. So I'd have like 8 or 9 permanently pinned tabs.
8 or 9, amateur. Yeah, I have like a dozen on every machine, at least a dozen different things permanently open, including Gmail and calendar and all that kind of stuff. I ain't got time to wait for Gmail to load when I open a new tab. I'm not waiting for that. I want to go Alt-1 and there's my email.
Well, you can still do that if that's your preference. I now like the fact that I have fewer tabs in my constantly open tab bar. And once you start building out connections to things in homepage, if you just start typing with the homepage loaded, it will search through the things you've configured. So now, if I open a new tab and just start typing mail and hit return, it will load Gmail because it's one of those configured places in my bookmarks. But bookmarks are only so interesting because they're static and boring. And then I found out that it's got a whole bunch of widgets for like these self-hosted things. So I started setting up some services. So this is in the services YAML for things like SyncThing. So my laptops and workstations and server have SyncThing running. And now I have a link to each SyncThing instance, but using their custom API widget, it now gives me the current status of each of those SyncThings in a little sort of widget in the browser box, including is it up and how quickly is it responding and how many files is it syncing and stuff.
You know what this is starting to remind me of? Those like desktop widget manager things where you could have on your desktop all sorts of little things telling you about the things that are running and how much disk space you've got and what music's playing at the minute. And rather than doing it on your desktop, because I've stopped doing that because I never see my desktop anymore because I've got apps open.
Right.
That would be Conky or Krellum or gcrellum or something like that.
That's the things I'm thinking about, yes. I couldn't remember their names.
I hadn't made that connection, but you are dead right, Mark. This is exactly what it's like. And being in the browser almost all the time, I see these things routinely now. So in addition to some home infrastructure checks for all of my SyncThing devices, all of the devices on my tailnet with metrics about where they are and if they're up, I've also added links to all of the critical infrastructure on my home network, like the printer and the router and the Philips Home Hub and things like this. So with a click, you can then go to those things. And at a glance, you can also see if they're up. And because they're all services now configured in homepage, when I open a new tab, if I want to go to the router, I just start typing router and hit return, and it opens a new tab with the router admin page open. It's very handy. But where it gets much more interesting, and this is where I see how I'm going to be using it in the future, is it has integrations for things like Nextcloud and Calibre Web and Plex and Jellyfin and Netdata and OpenWRT. In fact, there's over 100 of these like API integrations. So you can now drop a couple of lines of YAML and you can have a status overview of your Nextcloud or your status overview of your Calibre Web or any of the other services that you have on your home LAN. And I'm thinking that this is now something I'm going to build out in a lot more of a sort of a complete way on the home server that I'm going to be rebuilding. and use that as my sort of front page for managing the server. So I will automatically have Plex integrated into the server's homepage with all of the uptime metrics and who's watching what and how many streams are running, alongside all of the other infrastructure and metrics and data points for that server, everything a click away.
Having heard you talk about it, I think the problem I have is distraction. If I opened a tab and there was a whole bunch of shiny buttons with like numbers and stuff in them, it would massively distract me from what I'm really there for, which is to open a new tab so I can go and open another thing or search for something online. I think that's my problem. And so, yeah, I probably wouldn't want that. But I can see how it could be useful if you want a direct link to, you know, all these different things within your house. It does sound interesting.
Yeah, it's good for that sort of visibility. So I'm thinking setting up Home Assistant and having a Home Assistant widget in this to provide some integration there. But also, I find it useful for getting to those reference sites really quickly. So when I want to go and look at documentation, I have those as links in the bookmark section. I don't have to go clicking on the bookmark buttons. I can just start typing, and the quick launch of homepage will find the resource I'm looking for and just take me there quickly, which I'm really enjoying.
I am 100% certain someone is typing at you right now. If you just put them in the browser bookmarks, it would find them if you just started typing anyway.
I don't do bookmarks and haven't done for about 15 years or more.
Yes, you do. You've got bookmarks, just with more steps.
Well, they're not bookmarks. They're jump points. Anyway, I learned two other interesting things while setting this up. So I used browser policy to configure what I wanted my homepage to be in my browsers, which is homepage. I learned that Firefox only honors those settings if you're using Firefox ESR. If you're using a regular edition of Firefox, it ignores any of your preferences about configuring your tabs and home pages. So you need the new tab override add-on for Firefox to overcome this issue, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. And the other thing I learned is my OCD didn't like my homepage was localhost :8082, and I wanted it to be the host name of the machine. And I discovered that Kaddy, which is a sort of web server and reverse proxy, has an integration with Tailscale where if it detects you're configuring a domain ending in ts.net, which is what all Tailscale networks end in, it will automatically request a Let's Encrypt certificate from the Tailscale daemon and configure it in Kaddy. So I now have each of my hosts running on an SSL port with a proper Let's Encrypt certificate, which I thought was jolly lovely.
A friend of mine, who's a singer, songwriter, guitar player type, recently decided to home record an album. He's got one of these Tascam multi-channel home studio things, which he's been using to record at home and load all of the stuff into Audacity to mix and master it. But I'm not going to be talking too much about that because that's all happening on Windows. But he did invite me to play bass on his songs because that's something that I do sometimes. And I wanted to talk about a piece of software that I've been using to help me in the songwriting process. And that piece of software is Tux Guitar.
So I've seen that in like the, you know, archive repository on Linux distros. And I always thought that was like, you know, a Guitar Hero game.
Well, there is that kind of thing in the repositories, but it's not this. The one you're looking for there is called Frets on Fire. And that's been around for a very long time, as has Tux Guitar. So there's a file format called Guitar Pro, which is also a piece of proprietary software for handling guitar notation on a PC. And it's essentially the de facto standard for if you want to share guitar tabs with people, you use Guitar Pro in the Guitar Pro file format. And Tux Guitar can read Guitar Pro files on Linux.
Nice.
Being the one person who doesn't play any musical instruments, what is a guitar tab?
Okay, so you'd probably be familiar with what sheet music looks like. You have a stave with a load of lines and you have notes going up and down.
Blobs and lines, yes.
Yes, blobs and lines. So typically any instrument can have its music written like that, and so can guitar. But there's another way of writing music for guitar, which is where you have something that looks similar, where you have lines going across, but they represent the strings of the guitar. And then you have numbers, which basically show where you're fretting each string and playing the note as you go through.
And are they usually like little sections of it, like vertically, with little blobs of where you put your fingers and stuff?
That's probably chords you're doing, right? Chords, so that shows you the shape of a chord. And then you might have something which tells you which chords you're playing in a song, whereas this shows you the exact notes that you're playing and where you're playing them.
Right.
So when you have something like Guitar Pro, you actually have, you have the tablature, and then directly above it, you have the regular musical notation, and it's like a one-to-one match between them.
Got it.
So each note on the tab is a note on the stave. So yes, if you've ever been on a website and downloaded some guitar tabs, it'll either be a text file with like an ASCII representation of the tabs, or it'll be a Guitar Pro file. But I've been using this the other way around. So I'm not particularly knowledgeable in terms of musical theory and chords and scales and things like that. But what I can do is play. So I set about this by listening to the demo I was sent and playing along on my bass. And then I thought, well, I need to write this down because I'm going to forget it. And also, I wasn't really sure, does what I'm playing make sense? Does it actually fit in? Does it make sense as a piece of music? So I thought, well, if I can write down what I'm doing in Tux Guitar, then at least I'm not going to forget it. So I set it up to show me a bass tab with just four strings on it rather than the default six, because six is too many, and started like typing in the numbers where I thought they were. But the other thing that Tux Guitar can do is play it back to you. And in the bad old days, the first time I used it, you had to do this by having a separate MIDI server process running somewhere else, which you'd installed and got the socket address and whatever and pointed Tux Guitar at it. You don't seem to have to do any of that anymore. It just works. You say, oh, this part is played by this instrument, and you hit play and it goes. So what I found I could do there was set up what I thought I'd played, write it out, and then listen back to it and see if it was right. Like, does it sound like what I just played? And what I found very satisfactory when I did this was that actually once I'd got it all right and sounding right, I could look at the piece of music and it all fitted, like the length of each note added up. So it all fitted in each bar. And I actually had what looked like a real piece of music.
A real piece of music.
Can it go the extra step and turn the tabs into music?
Well, it does. As you're going along, you can either have it just show the tabs, or you can have it show the whole musical notation.
This is quite sophisticated.
So I knew enough from when I played recorder at school to know about, you know, quarter notes and half notes and things like that. So I could sort of work out, well, I think that, you know, relative to that, that was probably this size, and change it so they were the right length. And then the first time I did that, I realized I'd actually done everything twice as long as it needed to be.
Right.
Which I could remedy by doubling the beats per minute, and then it all sounded all right.
Yeah.
The other thing that's actually quite cool is printing. So you can obviously have this all up on screen, but there's a big old print button in the menu. And when you print it out, it actually prints it all out nicely set on the page. So it looks like exactly what you get if you buy a book of sheet music for guitar.
Oh, nice.
You can put in all of the parts that you want. You can put in lyrics if you want. You can put in notes to say, you know, here's the verse, here's the chorus, and here's whatever effect you have, tremolo and vibrato and other musical sounding words.
So you were doing one part of this composition with your friend who also does like vocal and other instruments. Were you able to put that all together within Tux Guitar, or were you only seeing your bass section? And did you then submit that to your friend and they were able to see it in whatever their software is, or was that not necessary?
That wasn't necessary, because my friend is an actual musician who can do this kind of stuff a bit more naturally than I can.
When you say naturally, you mean that he just knows what notes to write down?
He just knows what he played and how it went, basically.
Oh, right, okay.
And he has the feel for it and the muscle memory, and he doesn't necessarily know what the chords were, we discovered, but he knows what he did.
Right.
And he can do it again.
And can any of these pieces of software take the audio version, like you're stood there with a bass in your hand and play it, and it turn that into musical notation, or is that just too hard?
I don't think it's too hard. I don't know if Tux Guitar does it, but for example, I've played my bass through, there's a game called Rock Band, which is like Guitar Hero, but you do it with a real guitar.
Mm.
Like you actually plug in your guitar with a USB cable and it knows the notes you're playing and tells you whether you're playing the song right.
Wow.
What? There's an actual proper Guitar Hero where you actually play the instruments?
Yes. is called Rocksmith.
Is this on Linux or something else?
It's on Windows and Xbox, but I think it works with Wine Proton. I've never actually tried it because I had it on Xbox.
Well, now that's very interesting.
Oh, yes,
we've lost him. Turn into the Guitars Matters podcast very soon.
But yes, I would highly recommend anyone who plays guitar and is writing and wants a nice way of notating their pieces of music, Tux Guitar is definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to take a look. I've got some old pieces that I've got written down in paper tabs, and I'm thinking I might be able to digitize some of this for sort of posterity.
Yes, very nice.
At the weekend, I had a bit of quiet time because my wife and her friend went off to That London to see a concert at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium by the popular beat combo known as Pink. And I don't know who that is.
My hairdresser went to that too. She was just telling me about it today.
And so while I had some time to myself, I thought, I know, I'll go and play with some computers because that's a good occupation of my time.
Most unlike you.
Yeah, I know, right? And I found myself distracted by something called Gorse, which you may already be aware of, and I'm sure a lot of people are, but it's a command line tool that can create visualizations, OpenGL visualizations of source code commits. And so what you see when you run this thing is a window in which there's an animated scene where there is a interconnected network of nodes and little heads flying around, kind of zapping all the nodes. And that's the representation of people committing to code within this repository. And so you would run it in a Git repo, basically, and it will create this timeline of commits to a repository. And this dovetailed nicely with the two main open source products that the company I work for, Anchor, maintain. Sift and Gripe, the two main products, have just reached 4 years old. And I thought, oh, a nice way of celebrating 4 years. I'll make a little Gorse video. So I'm making this Gorse video. And then I thought, huh, I could do this in 4K. I could make it like super big. Because the default resolution is like, you know, 1024, 768 or something like that. It's quite small. And I thought, if I want to share this with everyone, I could put it on YouTube, but it'd be really nice if it was higher resolution. So I tried making it in 4K, which takes a lot more computing power and a lot more disk space in order to render out this file, and takes a fair amount of time, like 40 minutes or something like that, to render out this file. But I did it on my little ThinkPad Z13, and it was quite good. There's a few settings you can twiddle with, and you can also change stuff like the frame rate. So I decided to go for 60 frames a second, which is the maximum that Gorse will allow. And I thought, I wonder if I can go any higher than 60. What if I could do 120 frames a second? And I found myself in a little rabbit hole trying to generate 120 FPS Gorse video, animation video. But Gorse doesn't support 120 frames unless you grab the source code and you patch it. And so I patched the source code and changed it so that the max was 120, recompiled it, works fine. Then I ended up having this 120 FPS video that I actually couldn't upload anywhere because YouTube doesn't support 120 FPS, neither does Vimeo, which are the two places that we have video hosting accounts. So I kind of gave up on that because actually, even if I could upload it, who's going to watch 120 frames per second video of, you know, the visualization of a Git repo? Mm-hmm. Probably not many.
Does your monitor display 120 frames per second?
Also, no. So on the ThinkPad where I'm creating this thing, I can't even watch the thing as the director intended. So, I mean, in theory, I could move it across onto my Mac, my work computer, and on the internal display panel. It's one of these ProRes, not ProRes, what do they call it? ProMotion displays, which is variable refresh rate. In theory, I could watch it on that, but I'd be like the audience of one with this thing. So I gave up and I went back to 60 FPS. And then I thought, I wonder if I could make it in 8K. I thought, I wonder if I could render this thing out in 8K. And no, because the GPU in my ThinkPad that can do hardware accelerated video encoding has a maximum texture size or canvas size of 4K by 4K. And so it couldn't do 8K. I could do software rendering, but it would have probably taken a week to do it. So I gave up on that. I thought 4K is probably enough. But also it's quite nice because I could make the video 4 minutes long and it represents 4 years of development of Sift and Gripe, and I can do it in 4K. So it gave me like a catchy title for a blog post that I'll link to in the show notes. So I made a little blog post for work detailing how I made this thing. It was quite good fun fiddling around with it and generating this little visualization. A lot of people have done it based on popular projects. Some people upload them to their YouTube channels and stuff. People have tried doing Gorse videos for the Linux kernel in other like really huge projects. But it's actually quite tricky for Linux because there isn't a full single Git history of the whole project. Because before Git existed, it was all in BitKeeper. And people have written scripts that can do conversions and stuff, but there isn't really, as far as I could see, one single repository where you could get the full Git history all the way from the beginning to now without some significant additional post-processing. I ain't got time for that.
Huh. Interesting. I didn't realize that the Linux kernel in Git didn't have the complete commit history.
Yeah. If you do a bit of research, there's a few people who've tried to do this and a few people who've successfully, you know, mangled the data that was in BitKeeper and turned it into a Git repo. And it's certainly something I've looked at doing. And the other thing you can do is the little heads that fly around on the screen that touch all the various nodes. You can go and get the avatars for each of those people. So they've got their real, like their little GitHub, you know, avatars flying around the screen. And there's a piece of software written in Python called Git Faces, which is quite nice. And you just run Git Faces and it goes and downloads all the PNG files or JPEGs or whatever. And if you run that against the Linux kernel, there's a lot of avatars to download for all the committers that have ever committed to the Linux kernel. And obviously a lot of them did so before they switched from BitKeeper to GitHub. So yeah, that was all super fascinating. And I've played with that before, but I actually had to delete it all because it was taking up so much space, all these copies of the kernel with all these avatars and stuff in. Maybe I'll revisit that, or someone who's listening might revisit that and point me at someone who's already done it. I don't know.